Hello, everyone. Welcome to Conversations with Authors. This is a segment of Books Over Drinks. Our mission is to create a space where authors and readers can freely exchange ideas and discuss their work. Today, I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to host Dr. Sarah Federman, an author and conflict resolution professor at the University of San Diego's Kroc School of Peace Studies. Her book title, Transformative Negotiation, Strategies for Everyday Change and Equitable Futures, delves into the intricate dance of power dynamics and negotiations, weaving them into broader social issues like ethnicity, wealth, gender, age, and education. This is a fantastic book that we really hope you all enjoy. Dr. Federman, it is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
And it is fascinating how each concept in your book builds upon the previous one, creating a comprehensive mental roadmap for effective negotiation. So we can negotiate first without knowing what we want. But even if we know what we want, we still have to know how to ask. And that requires knowing how to listen. But if we're going to ask something that we may have to be willing to give something in return, and yeah. So on and so forth. So can you share your thoughts on how?
Yeah, well, one of the gifts about being able to write this book is that I was teaching negotiation at the same time over 15 semesters, over 15 weeks. So I got to plan, like, how do you build one idea to another and like, see, okay. And what's funny to me is that most negotiation books start with tactically, like how to get the stuff, but they don't tell you, like, how do you know what you want? Like, I don't know what do you really want? And why do you want that? And like, make you do that work. And then like, they tell you, you know, how to like save money on a car or get more money from work. But how do you know how much money you need or you have? Like, you have to know something about finance. So I went back and I was like, okay, so these are the steps that I would need. And that it sounded like my students also needed to like be able to come to the table really ready and clear and solid and confident, not confident, like just telling themselves they're a good person, like confident because you have knowledge that you need to move forward in the negotiation.
And as you were writing the book, can you share your thoughts as to how your book challenges conventional wisdom about negotiating?
Yeah, first, there's a lot of great concepts in conventional negotiation training. So I don't mean to like, none of that. It's just that context mattered more than I think I even realized until I met my students who are adults in Baltimore who are navigating really difficult contexts. And everybody listening may know Baltimore, but I'm sure there's parts of Miami that are a lot like Baltimore and parts of every major city that have like really challenging neighborhoods that have long been neglected for a variety of reasons. Historically and in the present, but the contexts were totally different. And first of all, the examples are often unrelatable. You know, if you're trying to figure out how you're going to feed your three kids and then go to college at the same time, or, you know, how you're going to change careers, you know, while you have a family or you're taking care of your brother, you know, you don't want to read about corporate boardroom negotiations. Like, you have a really different context that you're negotiating. Corporate boardrooms, also really important. Hostage negotiations with the Taliban, also really interesting, but like not the things that my students were relating to. And the rules of the game were different where they operated, which made me realize if they're different here, they're probably different in a lot of places around the world, and that people really would benefit from having some more culturally, contextually relevant advice.
That's very interesting. On the topic of the challenges that marginalized or under-resourced groups have or face, so recognizing that these are socioeconomic factors that are beyond an individual person's control, how do you empower these communities to learn to speak up and to learn to negotiate those factors?
One of the things that seemed helpful was to realize that not everything they were struggling with was personal, because, you know, you can just feel like everything's just so hard. I'm just so tired and I'm carrying so much. And they were tired and they were carrying so much. And so when you start to talk together about, okay, some of what you're carrying isn't yours, that gives you some freedom, because that affects your confidence, I think, because it affects your energy, but it affects what you feel that you deserve in the world, because there are these subtle messages passed down through the culture, maybe even through your parents, maybe even through your friends, of what you're allowed to have. So that was the first thing. The other is to acknowledge, holy cow, you've made it this far. and really to see themselves as very savvy negotiators already. They just didn't know they were, because their lives didn't match the book. So they thought like, oh, I don't do this, so I'm not good. And then tons of games to have them play in their lives and to see what they could negotiate for. And once they felt, whoa, like I'm actually amazing, they got more confidence. So I thought it was that three levels of acknowledging it's not all you, it's not personal. Also realizing that how it affects you on a subconscious level, and then playing with that and starting to experiment and try out different things and see if you can have more than you thought, even while the world is still filled with all kinds of isms and discrimination and marginalization and all kinds of things, you know, political disagreements, you can still have so much.
And vision is a recurring theme in your book, from understanding what we really want to even planning our financial goals, for example. Can you tell us a little bit about how the profound influence that of having a clear vision and the concept of soul goals and ego goals have, and how they relate on how they relate to negotiations?
Yeah, my prior career was in advertising, so I have a little bit of sense of what goes into making us desire things. And we are, I don't know about you all, but I am on social media, I'm watching things, I'm consuming messages of how I'm supposed to live. I'm hearing from colleagues and friends what they're doing, and that influences me. So it can be very difficult to get grounded in like, who the heck am I and what do I want and why do I want that? I mean, I might think a want is mine, but it got planted in my brain by like my best friend, a parent, an ad. Like, I don't even know what's me and what's been entered. So you referred to something that I learned from a friend of mine, which is making a list on your piece of paper, like your soul goals. Like, what does your soul want in the world? And then what does your ego want? Right? And be like, all right, my ego wants this. Like, let your ego have its day. Right? Be like, let it do all the things. And that's great. Right? And then the soul, like, what's going to like really fulfill me day to day? And that way you can sort of remember like my ego goal, right? So you could have like an ego goal for the book, right? Ego goal, like Oprah and Reese Witherspoon love it, right? But the soul goal is that everybody who touch it, it benefits their life in some way, right?
Yeah. And I'm assuming that there's always a point work of convergence between both of them.
Like soul isn't necessarily, the ego one isn't necessarily bad, but the ego one doesn't necessarily lead us to the greatest fulfillment if we just chase that one. And then we can also think our life can't be happy unless the ego gets everything that it wants, and it will never be satisfied.
And I remember having a conversation with Dr. Emily Balsettis about goal setting at some point, and she said that mental maps and vision boards are great, but not enough. It also requires some hard work. And I remember a story that I read on your book of one of the stories was Chris Wilson, a man who faced life in prison and underwent a complete transformation, led by a huge aspiration to transform his life while serving a sentence that could have as well may have been a life sentence. So can you tell us a little bit about him and how his experience can help us understand the importance of goal setting, but also working towards him?
Yeah, Chris Wilson is a really incredible, interesting human being. He's from Baltimore, and like so many young people there, he got caught in a situation where he had a gun on him and someone jumped him or scared him and he shot him and the guy died and he got a life sentence. And he didn't even want to carry the gun, but people told him he was being a wimp for not carrying a gun. So you're in these contexts where things happen, right? Like, and because there's so many guns and there's so much threat and so much pressure. And he ended up getting a life sentence. He spent years in prison and started reading a lot and started to develop a master plan for his life. There's a book about it. And I think there's going to be a Netflix series soon. And what was really interesting about Chris is that he convinced the judge to let him off the life sentence to let him live out this life plan. And there were other mentors that supported him along the way. And he came right out of the prison and came to the university where I was to continue his studies, because he had begun in prison and wanted to continue. And he convinced the dean in the parking lot to give him the entire education for free. And he's gone on and he's become an artist. And now he's creating a whole curriculum for Rikers Island inmates to help them develop and not give up on themselves and develop their lives as well while they're incarcerated and start to plan a future for themselves. So, you know, if you want to talk about a really tough spot, negotiating from the margins, there's not much more of a margin than a jail cell, you know, as a Black young man who's murdered somebody, you know, like in the inner city in the United States. So
And you touch upon something important where you said that he, just by simply kind of like navigating his way through basically the world, he was asking, he basically got a or convinced the dean of a university. So and by simply asking questions that, or asking for things that otherwise people wouldn't normally do. And that takes and that's another topic of your book, another theme of your book, where you talk about asking. There's a story about a gentleman on the book by the name of Fernando, I think. A very remarkable outcome just by simply asking a simple question. And in the same chapter, you mentioned a thought experiment that you gave your students, where they went basically into the world and asked questions that they wouldn't normally ask. So can you tell us about these examples, and specifically, why do people often avoid asking questions or asking, and how to overcome this limitation?
Yeah, this is great. I mean, so I had this friend, Fernando, who could ask, he just asked anybody for anything and they got all kinds of stuff. And it made me so uncomfortable. Like, I was just not used to it. I was like, wow, that was actually really effective. Like, how did he get that? And I just was like so repressed around asking, right? And, but started to play with it. Like, well, what happens if you ask for something really weird? Like, just see what happens. And had my students play this game. Initially, I just wanted them to get a no. I wanted them to practice hearing no, because, you know, it can really throw you when you're in a serious negotiation to have someone say no. And my father, who loved negotiation, said negotiation begins at no. He's like, oh, if someone tells you no, that's when it starts. But most of us hear no and like crawl away, you know, and we're like, I guess it's no. So I wanted them to practice hearing the no to move forward. But what happened was they went out and they got all kinds of stuff. They got dates. They got, you know, things done on their car. They got their mother to dye their hair and save them $50. They got, and they couldn't sort of believe what they could get just by asking. And, you know, they weren't allowed to ask for anything like use power over anyone. And you know, there were some like ethical rules. They couldn't put anything at risk for themselves, like their jobs or anything. You know, you don't want to do anything like that. But they started to play. So I think that's part of what we get trapped in ways of being, because maybe the way we're being worked really well when we were a kid in our family. Like, we learned how to navigate and it worked. So we like keep doing that and we don't keep experimenting that, like, oh, wait, like it's a habit. It becomes a habit. And then we get socialized. You know, people have written about this, like, anyway, Ram Hurray, about when you go into the post office, you act post office. There's like, oh, right? You go to a bar, you act bar. You go to a sports game, you act. There's different ways of being in every one of those rooms. Like, you're in a play. And if you can disrupt the play and do something that's un-post office in the post office, that's like still socially accept, you know, so, you know, can you, you know, give me some free stamps, or can you, you know, send this to my mom for free? Can you sign, do something, play with it. Don't act post office. Sometimes people are just like, it so disrupts the script that people then play with you in that space, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And do you think that we are socially conditioned to avoid asking questions? There was a good and interesting study.
Yeah.
There was a contrast between middle-class parents encouraging questions on their kids to ask questions. And in contrast, lower-class households teaching children to show respect or avoiding questions in the first place. And you even tie that to differences about like language and being foreign, to a quote of Sandra Cisneros' idea that when you're an outsider, you become silent. Is it to say that we're socially conditioned to sometimes to avoid asking questions in the first
absolutely place? Our families are often trying to protect us, tell us how to navigate the world, and sometimes that's useful and sometimes it can hold us back. You know, students won't ask questions sometimes because they're afraid of their, in our class, like afraid of their English, right? They don't want to speak up. I remember learning French. I mentioned to you that I'd learn French and I'd be in Paris and I would like practice my sentence all the way to the store, you know, like, so I could get it ready. But it made me shyer. And so if they came back quickly with something, I didn't have the response right away because the language, it took me time to construct it. Also feeling if you're an outsider that you don't deserve. Right. There's a lot of that. And there's a lot of messaging around that. It's not just that you don't feel that you deserve because you're in that culture. Other people in that culture want you to feel that you don't deserve either. Right. So it isn't all in your head. But we're thwarted. And that's why I think play can be very helpful. and for us to be aware of some of this social conditioning, you know, and sometimes it's useful. It helps us navigate dangerous places. And sometimes it really holds us back.
I remember that part of the book, if you remember, of a book that I read, Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, where he was speaking about a flight from Colombia, Avianca's flight from Medellin to New York that actually crashed. And unfortunately, many people died, or the people died. And but it was, I mean, of course, there's multiple factors that led to it. But one of them in particular was communication and the cultural difference between the Colombian pilots and how they were conveying and basically conveying the point of emergency to the tower, control tower, someone to people that spoke a different language and with a different cultural background as well. And kind of like me, when I was reading your book, I was thinking like, wow, I mean, the difference in even difference in culture can let to different outcomes in how conversations and negotiations go.
And funny that you mentioned that. I remember that reading that study, reading that in the book as well. And then just yesterday, a colleague was telling me about a study that showed that people don't like female pilots because they don't associate the female voice with being comforted, like confident, but they want the male voice. So there's this whole drama around pilots and gender. And so there are ways in which we're responded to really differently based on our gender, based on our culture, based on our accent, based on our, and all of those things exist. And I wanted to find a way to write about it that was acknowledging them without making you feel depressed that you can't have things because of that. Right. Because people, that was the trick I was trying to make happen.
No, it was definitely fascinating to hear that, just like I said, different upbringings, different socioeconomic situations can lead to completely different outcomes. Now, something that one sentence that really caught my eye and really, I don't know, just got to me when I was reading your book is when you mentioned that negotiations can enhance relationships because both parties are like can achieve what they want. And that was, I don't know, mind blowing to me. And just because I was thinking about persuasion instead of negotiation, I was thinking that the general position in a negotiation, isn't it an individualistic one? Isn't it kind of like the idea of winning an argument or getting the most out of a situation or out of the negotiation just for yourself?
Yeah, it's a really great point. So many people, this is what we first have to dispel, the myth that winning, that negotiation means win-lose. Uh-huh. That great negotiators, and this is what William Ury and many other of the great negotiating teachers have talked about for years, which is no, like great negotiators work together to find solutions that are even better than what each of you could have thought up on your own. So if we're talking and we understand the deepest soul goals of each of us, we may find really creative ways to meet them. It's the ego that thinks it's the zero sum, you know, that we're just one pizza that we're trying to pull from. When actually, no, like, and that's why actually, ironically, or maybe counterintuitively, I'd say, you want to negotiate with someone who's a very good negotiator. Because a great negotiator, a truly great one, not someone who just takes your stuff, but a truly great negotiator is going to make sure you're happy as well and is going to create more value. And if you're making a face that's like, oh, you don't quite feel right, they're going to say, what's wrong? You're not happy with this, you know? And this alone, helping people shift from that win-lose to that win-win and really collaborating together, can make a massive difference. And in a small town, like, you can't in Baltimore just keep ripping people off. Like, it's such a small town. People are going to learn. You have to create a good relationship.
Very interesting. Building, talking about shifting a little bit to the topic of money. Another whole chapter in your book, when you reference the misconception wealthy people had about being self-made, and which disregards the socioeconomic opportunities that they have. And we were talking, now that we're talking about Malcolm Gladwell, I think it may have been the same book where he was talking about Bill Gates, the success of Bill Gates, not just being just a byproduct of his passion and his brilliance, but it was also the fact that he was one of the first people who had access to a school who had access to one of the first laptop or computers.
I remember that. Well.
So you mentioned in the same chapter, for example, now we were talking about Baltimore, that Baltimore's the public being underbanked or unbanked, sorry, and underserved by the banking system. And what they have to then resort to going to predatory services like payday loans. So it's a huge misconception that people have, and you can hear it all the time where people say, I'm self-made, disregarding the being the byproduct of your environment.
And that doesn't mean to diminish the great work that people have done from where they've done a lot with what they've been given, but they've been given a lot, you know, and I had a great education, I had access to great resources and help when I've, you know, like great advice when I fell down, and, you know, and I look at what my students were up against and I was like, God, they don't have any of that. And look at how much they've done, you know? So I had a different level of appreciation for that. Yeah, it's really quite different. Like they were given financial advice. One student, more than one had said this, but one said that her family just threw away bills and hung up on the collections agencies when they called. And she said, I didn't know until my 20s that you could just pay these people, right? That was the advice she was given. But that distrust of the banks isn't just that her parents were stupid, right? It's that banks had historically abused her community in many ways through redlining and other things. So there were some historic reasons for that distrust, but it had now morphed into a way that was harming the community and harming the new generations. So there's a little bit of unlearning that has to happen too. That's not about being dumb. It's about being marginalized for so long.
Now, shifting gears, like I said, your book, one of the things that I love about your book is that it touches upon completely different topics and all converge in the idea of how do we become better negotiators. And one of them is technology. But one of the things where you introduce the chapter is by talking about the impact that it has in our ability to actually listen. And the mere presence of devices in our field of vision can impact our attention. So can you tell
us? Yeah. Oh my God. I love doing this research. It blew my mind. So I read a lot of Sherry Turkle and others who talk about these studies about presence and how it affects our relationships. But even seeing your iPhone like out of the corner of your eye, you know, decreases your attention level, actually, because you're being pulled to like what's all on there. Another study that showed that having your iPhone or smartphone on the table while you're talking to somebody actually made your conversations more superficial. I don't know if it's because we think that like we're thinking of other people that we think of on our phone, listening to that conversation, feeling it in your pocket even. So there's a lot about just like getting the darn thing out of the room. And, you know, we talk about this epidemic of loneliness that's now this crisis and how these tools connect us but isolate us, and becoming more conscientious about how we use them. And the other interesting study was that people blame the kids, but the kids are getting on them, they say, because their parents are addicted to them. So it's not the kids' fault. Don't blame them. It's the parents too who are addicted to their phones.
Now, you were talking about the recent kind of like shifts in people's habits, and out of the pandemic, another thing that happened was that people, I mean, there was a huge shift towards remote work. And in that chapter, you explore the complexities of choosing the appropriate communication channel whenever you're communicating or negotiating, whether if it's some require email or face-to-face or phone. So given the growing trend towards remote work, how do you see this cultural shift affecting our communications and even dynamic to work on negotiations?
I think we need to think a little bit about these platforms and which make the most sense. I don't know. I was asking my students, polling them this week. I said, has anyone ever won a text fight before? Because I'm still looking for the first person who's actually won a text fight or thinks they won. Right now, I need to talk to the other person. And no one was like, no, I've never won one of those. Right. So when you get to a point in a conversation, especially on text, if it starts to become emotional, you're starting to do emotional work, anything other than facts and just time and whatever, I'll see you Thursday, you got to get off the darn thing. And when you're negotiating, you know, video still is much better than phone. Don't try to solve an emotional problem back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Like maybe in the oldie times when you'd write a letter, you'd wait 6 months, you'd get it back, you'd process it, you know, and go back and forth. But really being careful about what work you're trying to do on these platforms, it can seem like sometimes an email is really good to say something that you need to really think about. somebody for whom the language that they're negotiating with is not a language that they're comfortable in. It's newer language to them. Writing is wonderful. Gives you time to think, gives you time to construct it the way you want. You may borrow AI, although be careful because, I mean, oh, it's so robotic sounding. But to native speakers, I mean, it's weird. So, but giving yourself that time can be good. You know, it doesn't mean that email is always bad. But so play to your strengths, understand what's comfortable for the other person. And by all means, stop freaking out when you don't hear from somebody in 24 hours, you know, or 72, you know, set expectations around when you might hear back from each other, just so you can get rid of that going on.
And one of the topics that you touched upon in your book that may be of interest to people, and after you gave a statistic, which I'll give you in a moment, that probably is more important. So is the topic of salary negotiations. And like I said, the most important, the most interesting aspect or the most interesting point that I read on that chapter was that the majority of these negotiations never actually happen. People just decide not to have those conversations, and you even call it or label it as an income loss, kind of like an opportunity cost of the income loss over time, because people just never want to have salary negotiations. Are these conversations inherently difficult, or and what strategies do you recommend for approaching?
That's great. So many people have never negotiated a salary in their life. They often don't know they can. They think that they, oh my God, I was offered a job. I really need the job, right? And so sometimes people just don't know that the other party has a range, and there you are trying to argue for why you want the top of that range. You don't know what that range is, so that's sort of tricky, right? So you gotta kind of do your research. You know, I've talked to some you know, different managers, and they're like, don't come in asking for 90 grand for like an opening position in the government job, right? Like, you got to show that you understand what the range is in your sector and for your experience level. So you got to show that education and then advocate for yourself. And know like government jobs are different than corporate jobs and different corporate sectors. So you want to know what salary you need. So do your personal finance to know what you can actually do. In the United States, you have to take care of yourself. You know, you gotta find healthcare really matters. Insurance matters, and for retirement. So find out how much you need, then how much you want, like how much, you know, you want to live the life you want to live, and then know your sector and be able to argue for yourself, advocate for yourself. And it's even good to find experts in your field. And that's what I found very useful. Like, you won't know everything about every field. What are other people getting? You know, seeing if you can get them to share with you a little bit about, you know, salaries. Or millennials tend to be much more open, I think, than the older generations about sharing that information. But getting advice, especially if you know someone who's negotiated with that person before, you definitely want to know how it goes. And gender and ethnicity can play a role in that. I talk about that in the book.
And talking about advice, I wanted to end our conversation on a lighter note. And
yes,
to ask you about what insights can we gain from dating coaches about the art of text communicating.
You know, when I was doing research for this book, I wanted to give you stories, but also back it up with research wherever I could find it. And when there was data, and I was like, oh, like, what about texting and negotiation? And the only experts I found who had any good advice were these dating coaches, these ones that the stars use. So I started watching videos from these dating coaches who worked with like Christina Aguilera and like all these, and what were they saying about texting? So I was like, okay, well, you know, that's pretty good advice. And actually it seems to make sense for negotiation. And he talks, you know, they talk about not playing games. So if you like, you get the text and you happen to be looking at your phone, write back to the person, you know, but like, don't have a monologue with yourself. Hey, how are you? You know, and if you don't hear from them, don't say, where you been? Sounds like you're doing something more important. You know, why don't I hear from you anymore? Bet you were somebody else. And then you've like written a like, entire. So there's some tips in there that I thought the dating coaches are really on about. And I think for now, we're going to have to draw our negotiation tips from them until we get some stronger data in our field.
The book is fascinating. I really hope that you all enjoy it just as much as we have. The book is called Transformative Negotiation. It's written by Sarah Federman. Dr. Sarah Federman. And remember to stay curious and keep the passion for books and ideas alive. Dr. Federman, thank you for joining us today, and we hope to have you back soon.
Thank you. And people can go to my website and say what happens when they try the exercises. Would love to hear from them.
Fantastic.
All right, ciao. Thank you.